This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with another of Terry's interviews with John Waters. This was in 2010, when Waters had just written a book called Role Models, about the people who have inspired him. The sources of his inspirations also are at the center of a new retrospective of his visual art, presented in his hometown by the Baltimore Museum of Art. That exhibition, called John Waters' Indecent Exposure, opened last Sunday and runs through January 6th. In his book, Role Models, John Waters named some of the people who had inspired him and explained why. Some, like Tennessee Williams, weren't that surprising, but others were. Like one of the female former followers of Charles Manson, or like popular 50s singing star, Johnny Mathis.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you. Just because my...
John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you for having me again.
So I'm going to start by asking you to read from the first chapter of Role Models, and this chapter is about Johnny Mathis, who was... shockingly, one of your role models. So why don't you read an excerpt of that for us?
I wish I were Johnny Mathis. So mainstream, so popular, so unironic, yet perfect. Effortlessly boyish at over 70 years old, with a voice that still makes all of America want to make out. Heavenly, warm. Yes, I'll say it out loud. Wonderful, wonderful. Is it because Johnny Mathis is the polar opposite of me? A man whose greatest hits album was on the Billboard charts for 490 consecutive weeks versus me, a cult filmmaker whose core audience, no matter how much I've crossed over, consists of minorities who can't even fit in with their own minorities? Do we secretly idolize our imagined opposites?
That's John Waters reading from his new book, Role Models. I was shocked to see that Johnny Mathis was like the lead chapter.
He probably was too.
Well, I mean, he's, as a singer, he's such a romantic. And you're so not in your art. I can't speak about your private life. So what is the attraction to him?
Well, because Johnny Mathis is the opposite of me. Because Johnny Mathis to me... is the kind of mainstream that I will never, ever be able to have. And everybody wants to have hits like that. But at the same time, Johnny Mathis said to me, I always wanted to be a jazz singer. So in a way, your opposite sometimes isn't exactly what you believe him to be, too. So I didn't know Johnny Mathis. And to get to meet him was not easy because I'm sure they Googled me and I'd be nervous, too. So he was lovely, though, when I went to his house and everything.
So I always assumed that the reason why Johnny Mathis didn't do a lot of interviews was because he was in the closet and didn't want to have to speak
about that. Well, I wrote to him
about that.
Saying that I was not coming to him with any agenda, sexist, moral, racial, anything. And I didn't. And I didn't. And I never asked him those questions. I don't really think, obviously, if he wanted to talk about any of his personal life, he did. He just said some of my fans think they're Mrs. Johnny Mathis. You know, and I know what he meant. What does he have to share his public life with? I'm not always for that. You know, I get weary of reading these people that tell every personal thing to reporters they just met that day. And that's when I realized they don't have friends. That's what friends are for, not reporters.
So you mentioned Tennessee Williams. He's a chapter in your book, Role Models. And I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on Tennessee Williams.
Okay, this one is called, The Kindness of Strangers.
Let me just say, this is John Waters, who is my guest. His new book is called Role Models, and each chapter is about somebody else who, in one way or another, was a role model or an inspiration for him. So this is Tennessee Williams.
Years later, Tennessee Williams saved my life. The first time I went to a gay bar, I was 17 years old. It was called The Hut, and it was in Washington, D.C. Some referred to it as the Chicken Hut, and it was filled with early 1960s gay men in fluffy sweaters who cruised one another by calling table to table on phones provided by the bar. I may be queer, but I ain't this, I remember thinking. Still reading everything Tennessee Williams wrote, I knew he would understand my dilemma. Tennessee never seemed to fit the gay stereotype, even then, and sexual ambiguity and turmoil were always made appealing and exciting in his work. My type doesn't know who I am, he stated, according to legend. And even if the sex lives of his characters weren't always healthy, they certainly seemed hearty. Tennessee Williams wasn't a gay cliché, so I had the confidence to try to not be one myself. Gay was not enough. It was a good start, however.
So he gave you confidence to be gay but not fit a stereotype of gay. What were some of the other...
He gave me the confidence to be a beatnik, really, to be a gay beatnik, or to be a beatnik who was gay. That's very different. You know, you went into a field of all different kinds of rebels, and their sexuality was always still my friends. Or it doesn't matter if they're gay or straight. If I'm friendly with somebody, that has literally no interest to me whether I like the person or not. And I'm always amazed by people that say, oh, you should go with this age and he has all gay people. Well, when I go with him, like saying he has all black people. Are they good? Are they bad? I mean, that's what counts. So I always liked the gay people that had trouble even fitting in the gay stereotype, because I don't like rules of any kind. And I seek people that break them with happiness and not bringing pain to themselves.
So how have you changed in terms of what you want to do with your fame and with people's interest in your life? Because in some ways you've turned yourself into your art, you know, because you do shows, one-man shows, you've written more personally, you know, over the years, and people are dying to hear about you.
Well, I don't know. I use my own personality to find out about others. My personality is why probably Johnny Mathis let me in the house, or why the outsider pornographers I left in the house let me in and trusted me. And I think I've only written about people that I look up to, that have, even if they've had terrible things happen in their life, because they've had a more extreme life than I've ever had. And I respect people. I, as a writer, every day think, what would it like to be that person? And if you're a journalist or a writer, you get to be that person. Wouldn't everybody like to barge in people's house and ask them personal questions? I don't get why everybody doesn't want to do that. But when you're writing a book, you're allowed to do that. That's acceptable. And that's why people tell me everything. On airplanes, strangers confide in me the most deepest, darkest secrets. And I think because they think I'll understand. And I generally do understand. I've taught in prison. I've counseled people. I actually would be a good defense lawyer. I would be a good counselor. I would be a good shrink, actually. And I believe in all those things. I've been arrested. I've been to the psychiatrist. So I think you have to participate in whatever business it in you are trying to be involved in.
So getting back to Tennessee Williams, you've read all of his books, and you've read all of lots of people's books. You collect books. You have over 8,400 books, all cataloged.
I like to read books. I don't collect books. Sometimes people say they collect books and they don't read them.
Yes.
I like to read. People always say to me, how can you read so much? And I say, easy. You don't have a boyfriend or girlfriend, and you don't watch television. It's simple. You'll read all the time. And I'm on airplanes all the time. So it's I love to read. It's how I relax. I don't find that a compulsion. Cataloging them is being nice to my heirs.
Do you have heirs?
Of course. As much of a control freak as I am, you don't think I have my death plotted? I even know where I'm going to be buried. We all bought plots. A lot of my friends were, it's like People's Temple graveyard.
Well, I know. And you say that is it the same cemetery that Divine
yes.
is in?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't mind asking, why do you want to be buried?
Because I love the idea of graveyards. I like people visiting. I used to go in graveyards when I was young, and Divine would steal flowers for parties. We'd have a couple beers. I like the atmosphere. I like the worms go in, the worms go out. I believe in the resurrection, the only thing I've been ever taught that sounds like a good idea. But then I panic about real estate prices and what are we supposed to wear and are we nude? So I go into that in the book, my paranoia about the recession.
You're the only person I've ever asked that to who wants to be buried because, like, you really like graveyards.
Oh, yeah. I do like graveyards. A lot of people like graveyards. They're peaceful. They're quiet. And we're all going to be buried, so all our friends can have one-stop shopping. You know, if you want to come, you can say hi, Mink, hi to everybody around. And I like the idea of it. It's and my mother, at first, I thought it would be strange to tell my own family, because my mother said, I think it's a great idea, because not your sister's going to be buried where her husband is, you know. So I like the idea.
Did your parents feel bad that you're not getting buried next to
no,
them?
No, they didn't. I was afraid to tell them. They thought it was a fine idea. They totally understood. I went to the graveyard where he is buried, And
were divine asparagus?
My father.
Oh, your father's
and
buried,
they quoted me prices that I didn't know. I never bought a grape, but it sounded like a ripoff to me. And they showed me like tombs, like they thought Rudolph Valentino was coming out there they were going to sell to. And I thought, wait a minute. So I went and asked the woman where divine is because I liked the little graveyard. And she told me a price. I said, I'll take a double. I got like a lot of room around me too because the price was quite fair.
Two bathrooms?
Yeah. It's like a two bedroom.
So have you thought through like what kind of like tombstone you want?
Oh, yes. I kind of want it to be modeled after Pasolini's. And I want mine to just say, my father's is the same, and I didn't realize it until I saw it recently, his graveyard, because he only died a few years ago. Just say, John S. Waters Jr., the day I was born, the day I was died. Who wants to risk a joke that has to last eternity? Humor changes. Talk about an old joke. It was on your. I think it's the only time it should be quite simple on your gravestone.
What's on Divine's stone?
Praying hands, but his parents put his real name and Divine on it, which was quite loving. Uh-huh. And people, oh my God, they write stuff all over it, and they leave stuff and leave donuts and dresses, and it's visited quite a lot.
So let's get to somebody else in the book, and this is Ray Kawakubo. Thank you, and he's a designer.
He's a woman. Yeah.
She's a designer who was not known to me.
She's pretty famous. She did Comme des Garçons, one of the first Japanese fashion labels that deconstructed fashion. She's been around quite some time, hugely successful in Japan.
Okay. You describe your look as disaster at the dry cleaners.
Yeah. I like her clothes. She always has something the matter with it. Something so I love the idea. When you spend more money than you should on an outfit for fashion, no one thinks you spent money. They think you got it for a nickel somewhere in a thrift shop. But actually, since it's on purpose, it's like getting dressed in reverse. It's sneaky fashion. It's wearing outfits that you like that regular people just think is something the matter with it, and you got a bad coat on. I mean, I see people on the street that are homeless that actually look like outfits that I've paid a lot of money for. And I find that delightful. I find it delightful. My father used to say, you bought that something. They saw you coming, boy. But they did see me coming. And I was eager to get it.
Okay, this is far too personal.
Yes.
So I'll try it anyways. Do you like costuming when it comes to actual sex?
No. You mean does someone have to be in a certain outfit? No, I'm not that specific. Thank God. But what somebody has on, I always really think that if boys turn their belt halfway to the right, like so the buckle is in on the side, Marlon Brando did that, Joe D'Alessandro did that. It's a look of confidence I like. I like somebody that pulls off an effortless look. But no, I don't have to have somebody dressed as an airline pilot or that kind of I would start laughing.
That's what I was wondering. Is there something that's inherently absurd at some point?
Everyone's sex life is funny except your own. Really, it is. Every person's is. And yours never is.
Why is that?
Well, because the lengths that people go to and the extremes and the conditions and the mental exercises and guilt and shame and the happiness that everybody goes through and what they'll do for sex is never ending and mind boggling and very interesting to me. And I don't think a lot of times people choose any of it. A friend of mine, I think I have it in this book, where her mother had Alzheimer's and she for years, so she knows a lot about Alzheimer's, the community. And I said, well, ask them, do people forget if they're gay or straight? And the worker said, never once. They don't know who their family is. They don't wreck anybody's. But no one suddenly doesn't remember if they're gay or straight. Well, doesn't that prove, really, that you're born that way?
Okay, so I want to quote something you say in the book. You talk a little bit about being in therapy and you say, a psychiatrist once told me early in treatment, stop trying to make me like you. And what a sobering welcome smack in the face that statement was. Yet, somehow, every day of my life is still a campaign for popularity, or better yet, a crowded funeral.
Well, isn't everybody in show business under the same thing, that they're insecure people that have to go into a field that where strangers have to tell them they're good for the rest of their life? I figured that out a long time ago. Yes, I thought it was a great thing when the shrink said that. I'm not there to make friends. You're supposed to talk about the things that make you the most uncomfortable. I'm paying for this. Let's get my money's worth. So I used to, after that, go in and think of the things that made me the most uptight to talk about, which is what you're supposed to do with a psychiatrist. I believe in the talking cure. You know, Freud said the best thing ever. That line that's, I think, so brilliant is turning hysterical misery into common unhappiness. What a great, great line.
But I find it such a paradox in what you spelled out there, that you're the person who has, like, defied every convention in your life and in your art. The person who you say, even you're a minority group, you're an outsider of. And I mean, you turn that into an art and a career, and yet you try to get your psychiatrist to love you, and you say that every day in your life is a campaign for popularity. Isn't that a paradox?
No, I think it's probably being a healthy neurotic. Everything that I'm trying
to
be.
Healthy neurotic.
Yeah,
only paradoxical enough.
But only a neurotic cares if everyone likes them, you know. And in show business, certainly, it is or politics. It's all the same thing. You have to get people to like you. And by writing books, by making movies and everything, I think you're continuing to do that. And a crowded funeral is a nice thing. I like that. But the older you get, the less chance that has of happening. That's another reason to make younger friends. So they can fill in, like at the Oscars, when somebody goes to the bathroom, they have somebody that sit in the seat. I want them at the funeral.
You know, because as you've said, you've made a living selling shock.
Well, surprise, I think.
Surprise, yeah. And some of your films, particularly some of your early films, like Pink Flamingos, have some very, like, vile, repulsive thinking people in them.
Mm. I don't know that I totally agree, but okay.
Okay.
They were certainly using anarchy to get their point across, and they were rebelling against their particular worlds at the time and lusting after things that maybe you shouldn't. But I think the morals in all my films were quite obvious, and the good guy won in every one of the movies.
Nevertheless, I think people are really surprised by how just kind of like nice and funny and easy to talk to you are, like earlier in your career, before there was as public a John Waters as there is now. I think people thought that you would be this really peculiar person who might really traffic in filth. And
in the old days, they did. Yeah, I used to shop at colleges, and they'd have a pound of marijuana in the car for me. Please, please. I don't want to do this. Yeah, I think in the beginning. But I think through writing books maybe more and more of my public speaking and stuff is that they realize that I'm not the characters I think of. But no director is usually. Not that many of Stephen King go out there and do that. I mean, why do they think I would?
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's always really great to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. The Baltimore Museum of Art has just opened a major retrospective of his visual art and published a hefty companion volume. Both are called John Waters, Indecent Exposure, and the exhibition runs through January 6th.